This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, Happy New Year, and you're listening to Live and Learn with me, Dashran Johan. And for our first Live and Learn of the new year, I thought it'd be a good idea to reflect on some of the lessons we've learned in 2020 when it comes to politics and discuss ways in which our nation can strengthen our institutes of democracy. As always, I can't do this alone. So joining me via Skype right now is Thomas Fan, the chairperson of Bursay 2.0. Welcome to the show, Thomas. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you, Dashan. I'm doing good. Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you too. So let's talk about 2020 for a second, right? It was a pretty unprecedented year in Malaysian politics, and I think that would be an understatement. I mean, we had Langkah Sheraton, which saw the collapse of the federal government and the formation of a new government without an election. We also saw high levels of party hopping at state and federal levels. How do you think the events of 2020 impacted our pillars of democracy in the country?
Yeah, wow, what a year 2020 to Malaysian politics, and, you know, with the COVID pandemic and the economic crisis that followed, you know. But about Malaysian politics, truly, you know, what happened with the Langkah Sheraton or Sheraton move, I think really has tested our democracy to the limits. But what it also does is it exposed the many weaknesses that exists within our current laws that allow for such a thing to happen. And it doesn't look like it's going to go away, but this is going to be like the new normal, the changes of government through the factions.
Bursay 2.0 recently released a statement, I think a few days ago, on the changes that we need to see to make Malaysia a healthier democracy. And one of them that's mentioned is that all parties should be given greater freedom and stronger incentives to compete maturely. What does Bursay mean by this?
Well, I think the fact of the matter right now, you know, is that unless you are in government, you don't really have much of a role to play as far as policy, or as far as even just contributing to the discussion and nation building if you are in opposition. So I think this is currently the situation that is happening. And that also partly explains why people, politicians are eager to be in government, so that they can actually not just have a meaningful role to play, but they are able to perform what they were elected to do. Because as it is right now, there's very little that opposition can do.
Now, what do you mean by that? Because, you know, on paper, how our election works is that we are technically not voting for the Prime Minister, or even perhaps voting for the government itself, right? We are voting for the MPs to represent our constituency. But as you mentioned, and as many experts have mentioned, our current political system also doesn't necessarily reward that. And unless you are in power, unless you are in government, there's very, like you mentioned, there's very little that opposition politicians can do, even for their constituencies. Would you say that this is a fair statement?
I think that is quite fair. For one thing, it's true that when we vote, we are voting for an MP that represents us in our constituency.
That's right.
And then these MPs, if they are part of the majority that forms the government, then from among them choose the Prime Minister. So we do not elect the Prime Minister directly. But if we are choosing someone who ends up being in the opposition, and we really don't know whether who will become government or opposition until after election day. But if they are in the opposition, the current situation is that they are pretty much kept out of, for example, roles to play in the parliament. In fact, things have been improving since Pakatan took over with the formation of parliamentary select committees. But prior to that, if you are in opposition, you actually have very little to do other than attend parliament in the 60-something days that they meet in a year. So, and also, there is, you, if you are in opposition, you would not get any allocation at all in the past. But now things are improving, where we hear that even though you are in opposition, you get some sort of allocation, not as much as the government MPs, but you do get some allocation. So things are improving, but still far from ideal if you are in opposition. That's why there is a need for a more meaningful role for the opposition to play in our democracy.
You mentioned parliament, and even there, opposition doesn't actually have much power, do they? For the most part, parliament is like theatre. There's a lot of yelling and debates, but when it comes time to vote, everyone remains partisan.
A lot of time it's more like a circus, you know, with all the shouting that is going on and insult and, you know. But, you know, that's not the way it should be. I think a healthy parliament is one where elected MPs can come together to contribute to the improvement of the laws that are about to be introduced and that are about to be imposed upon the rakyat, where they can discuss in the best interest of the country. Now, it's very hard if all you have is, like you say, that 60-odd days in that big hall, they want rakyat, and you are given that piece of legislation like a day or a few days before they are supposed to be debated. You can't have a meaningful contribution to that piece of legislation. But what has been happening slowly, but has been taking place since 2 years ago, and I'm glad to see that even is continuing right now under Perikatan Nasional, is the formation of this parliamentary select committees, where MPs from both sides of the divide are represented in thematic, or rather in this case under Perikatan, they shadow the ministries that are existing. So there will be a parliamentary select committee on, for example, on environment. So MPs from both sides would then, away from the main hall, go through legislation on environment and discuss without shouting at each other. I think that is a healthy development, but we want to see more parliamentary select committee and that MPs actually have a more meaningful role to play from both sides of the divide. So I think we are moving in the right direction, but very, very slowly.
And what exactly can we do about this? Because we talk about, you know, our elections being sort of a winner-takes-all situation. We talk about the debates in parliament just being sort of a talk shop. What can we do? How do we empower the opposition?
Well, I think, first of all, we always have to make sure that there is an opposition. You know, the government is only as good as the opposition. So if very weak opposition, weak in terms of number, weak in terms of alternative policies and ideas, then you're going to have a government that is very lackadaisical, you know, that is going to just take it easy and taking the people for granted. But when you have a strong opposition that is holding the government of the day to account, that, I think, is going to keep any government on their toes. Now, how can we help? I think we are pushing for, like in Bursay, what we're doing is pushing for reforms in this area of parliament, where we ask for parliamentary select committees and roles for the opposition. And we push for a shadow cabinet, for example, to shadow the government of the day. Now, that is not a recognized institution right now, mm-hmm. like it is in the UK, for example. If you are in opposition, you form a shadow cabinet, you are given an allocation by the government, you have access to information, you are briefed on key areas that affects the nation. We don't have that mechanism right now. But I think it is imperative that whether it is Bursa, civil society, or members of the public, we keep on pushing on that, that we need to have a strong opposition and they have to be treated fairly.
Do you think because of the nature of our political landscape, having too strong an opposition can also mean that MPs aren't focusing on governing the country, but rather just always at the edge of their seats, worried about losing power or excited to gain power?
Well, I mean, the problem of defections and the collapse of government actually it has got nothing to do with the numbers of the opposition. We must not forget that when Pakatan Harapan fell in February last year, they had a very comfortable majority, just 10 short of two-third majority. And yet they fell just because of about 11 MPs that chose to go the other side and several others that followed them. So what is needed when I mean a strong opposition is an opposition that accepts their place in opposition for the five term that the election has given them. When we go for election every 5 years, we give a 5-year mandate to the government, but also a 5-year mandate to the opposition to play their role. They have to accept that that is their role for the next 5 years until they have an opportunity to become the government of the day. Now, in that 5 year, what they can do if they are a good, a strong opposition is that they come up with alternative policy and ideas that pushes the government to refine and improve on their own performance or pay the penalty. And also a good opposition would take the opportunity to negotiate for reforms in the country that would benefit the citizen. Right now, in terms of number, I think we got the strongest ever opposition ever in this
That's
country.
Right.
They are just like too short of being the government themselves.
Right.
And yet, I think one of the disappointments that we observed in the last few months, when they had such an opportunity with the need to pass the budget, they did not use that opportunity, their strength, to negotiate for more substantial reform, you know, like equitable constituency development fund allocation, more parliamentary select committees. These are substantial reforms that I think they could have said, look, if you want us to support the budget, you know, we want to see this reform. So this is what we call a confidence and supply agreement, mm-hmm. where they are in opposition, but they can negotiate with the government of the day for not just changes to the budget, but also reforms in the country. I think that's what we need to see more from the opposition today.
I think most of us are in agreement that 2020 exposed a major flaw in our system. I'm talking about party hopping. The thing is, it's allowed by the Constitution, and it's allowed because we don't want to restrict freedom of association. In principle, if an elected official doesn't agree with the party's stand anymore, they should be allowed to leave and join a party that aligns with their own ideals. In reality, we know that every MP who party hops will say that it's for the betterment of the rakyat, right? So how do we maneuver this situation?
Yes, I think after the Sheraton move, it became very obvious to everyone, especially with the collapse of the various state governments, that we need to have a law or a mechanism to prevent party hopping. But as you correctly pointed out, people hop sometimes for legitimate reason, because they no longer believe in the direction of the party that they were part of, or they disagree with the corruption that is taking place. You would, if that was the case, you would want your MP to leave that party. But if you have an anti-party hopping law in place, then it does not discriminate. In other words, anyone that leave the party or is sacked by the party, automatically that seat will be vacated and there will be a by-election. But what we are recommending in Bursay from the very start was that you have a mechanism called the recall election.
Right.
Now, what that is that it gives voters in that constituency of the, say, the MP who defected, that constituency, the voters, if they are not happy with what has taken place, they can trigger a process where they can sack that MP. I think this is extremely empowering to the voters who right now, as it stands under current law, can only watch helplessly as their MP, whom they voted because they thought they are part of this government, suddenly become part of that government. So recall election doesn't automatically trigger a by-election. But if enough voters in that constituency believe that what he or she did was wrong, they can trigger a process to remove and have a by-election and restore the mandate that they wanted. So this is, to us, a much more what I call a surgical approach to a problem that is there. That is the defection of MPs. Most of them will say, we defect for the right reason, because they will never admit that they defect due to money or power. None of them will admit that. Yeah.
On that note, we do need to go for a very quick break. I'm speaking with Thomas Fun, the chairperson of Bursay 2.0, on the reforms we need to see in 2021 and beyond to strengthen democracy in the country. This is Live and Learn, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Live and Learn. I'm Dashran Johan, and joining me on Skype is Thomas Fun, the chairperson of Bursay 2.0. And we are talking about some of the flaws in our democratic institutions right now and the reforms that need to take place to strengthen our democracy going forward. Right now, Thomas, we seem to be in an age of coalition politics, right? And every party seemingly needs to align themselves with one of the major coalitions. So right now, we have two sides of the divide. And even, for example, when we saw YB Said Saleh announced his new party, MUDA, everyone was quick to, you know, ask, okay, which side is he going to align himself with? Is he going to be part of Pakatan Harapan? Is he going to be with the whole PNBNMN side? And this, I feel, it doesn't create an environment where parties that represents a certain set of ideals, it's difficult for them to just thrive on their own because they ultimately need to align themselves with one side or the other. What can we do to create an environment where smaller parties can thrive?
Yes, I think that you're right. This is a real challenge right now. And the reason for this is the electoral system that we have right now, which is called first past the post. That is where, you know, in a constituency, it is the candidate who has won the most number of votes who gets elected. It doesn't matter that this candidate got less than 50% of the vote. And if, let's say, there is a three-way contest and the winner is the one that got 33% of the vote, that person is the one elected.
That's right.
Now, in that situation, it is very difficult for a third force or an alternative party other than the two main competing party to come in, unless the candidate himself or herself is extremely popular on the ground. But a lot of time when it comes to an election, voters, even if they don't discuss among themselves, they vote strategically. In other words, they vote for the party that they think has the best chance of forming government.
Right.
Even if they hate that candidate, you know, that was fielded by this party, they would vote for the party. Now, a very good case in point was at the last election in Sungai Siput in Perak, where we had an incumbent, Michael Jayakumar,
mm-hmm.
who was a two-term MP and an extremely good MP by every account. At the last election, he chose not to come under the Pakatan Harapan banner or the PTR banner, but to compete under his own party, which was Party Socialist Malaysia, PSM. Now, everybody thought that he might stand a chance to at least see some of the votes and even win. But the truth was that when he came for election, he lost his deposit.
Right.
You know, even such a popular MP lost his deposit because people, when it comes to voting, vote strategically for one of the two that has the most chance. So if we want to see a smaller party having a chance, then we got to talk about changing the electoral system to a more proportional system where the seats allotted to you depends on the percentage of vote that you have collected nationally or statewide. You know, if you get 20% of the votes, then you get 20% of the seat. So if you're a small party, you got 5% of the vote, you got 5%
right.
of the seat. In this, right now, there's no possibility of that. But that has been one of the thing that we are advocating for, to change the electoral system.
Do you think local council elections can sort of balance this out a bit? Because as we know, the opposition has been pushing Putrajaya to institute local council elections, and this has been suspended since 1964, right?
It's extremely, extremely important. I think not just for small parties and even independent candidate to have an opportunity to serve the community, but it is extremely important for democracy in this country that that it goes down to the local ground level, simply because democracy is about representation. And under the current situation, people may not realize that when it comes to their local authority, where they are actually paying taxes and rates on a yearly basis, they are not represented in the council. In other words, the councillors that are supposed to serve them are not elected by them, but appointed by the ruling party of the state. Now, democracy should be there, but in Malaysia, one of the things that has happened over the years is the over-concentration of power in the hand of Putrajaya, the federal government. We are talking about 8% of decision-making resources being concentrated in Putrajaya. And for the state, they have 10 to 15% of decision-making power and resources. And out of that 10 to 15, a huge part of it is the local authority, the local government. So that's why if you want to see a restoration of local council election, you have to rebalance the balance of power between the federal government, the state government, and also the local government, so that each of this government has a role to play. But right now, almost everything is in the hand of Putrajaya.
And on that note, do you also think that Malaysia could then benefit from a more decentralized system, something like the US perhaps?
Certainly. Decentralized means more accountability, I believe, by people at the local level, but also competition among themselves to outdo themselves, to outserve themselves. Now, accountability also means a check on corruption. So if there is an elected local authority, for example, any local authority that is not performing well, not serving the ratepayers well, stand a chance to be removed at the next election. And because of that accountability, I think it will lead to better efficiency and delivery for the people.
Do you also think that decentralization could maybe heal some of the polarization that exists in our country, or at the very least lessen the tension? For example, liberal states can have liberal laws, conservative states can have conservative laws. Do you think that could work?
Yeah, I think that is a very, very good point. That I think decentralization allow for nuances, you know, change, different state and even different local authority to have different policy and guidelines that suits the majority of the population that they are serving. So rather than one size fit all for the whole country or for the whole state, you have this ability to adjust to suit the local condition. But I also want to take it a little bit further on that point. Mm-hmm. I think one of the concerns that people with the consideration of local council election is that it will bring too much politicking to the ground, you know, to the local community, when already at the national level, we have all these communal concerns and racial concerns. So if we bring it down to the ground, it's going to get worse. Well, I totally disagree, simply because we all live in neighborhoods, mm-hmm. you know, and we have local neighborhood issues that affects every one of us, regardless of race or religion. And these are the issues that would unite, I believe, even the neighbors to talk to each other more, because simply they know that they have now the ability to solve the local problem by addressing it to the local council. For example, security. Let's say if there's a neighborhood where there's a lot of security concerns, snatch thief and robberies going on, I think it would unite the neighbors, whether you're Malay, you're Indian or Chinese, to come together and say, look, we got to do something. We got to deal with this problem. Let's talk to our councillor. Or if it's a rubbish problem, because, you know, the rubbish smell the same to whatever race or religion. They're just a bad thing. So I think this really would allow people to look beyond the macro differences that they have in race and religion that are spilled out by politicians at the national level, which actually doesn't affect them locally. So I think more democracy on the ground would actually bring the people together.
And in your press release, you also talk about the need for a politically independent public prosecutor's office separate from the Attorney General's chambers. Why is this important and how do we achieve it?
Okay, right now, the Attorney General is also the public prosecutor. Mm-hmm. He is one and the same person. But there is a conflict of interest here, simply because the primary role of the Attorney General is to advise the government of the day on legal matter,
correct,
on constitutional matter. It's like the lawyer to the government. And yet, the public prosecutor is someone that has to decide on whether a case should be prosecuted or not. And we have seen it in our recent history. The Attorney General, instead of taking action against the Prime Minister, protected him. So this is a clear conflict of interest. And we say that there should be a separation of the two offices. There should be a public prosecutor that is independent, that is not influenced by the Prime Minister of the day, that is able to look at the case independently and make a decision.
And speaking of leaders, you know, especially prime ministers who, you know, perhaps are corrupt, do you think that another problem with the political system in Malaysia is that there's too much power vested in the Prime Minister's office. You know, many argue that this is also one of the reasons why a lot of the MPs always have one eye on the proverbial iron throne, shall we say, instead of focusing all their attention on policies.
Definitely fair and accurate. In fact, as it stands right now under current law, the Prime Minister effectively is almost like a dictator in our country.
All right.
The law allows the Prime Minister to, for example, appoint people to all the key positions. The judges, the Prime Minister has the sole prerogative to appoint the Chief Judge, Chief Justice, and all the other Chief Justice of the different states and areas. He has the prerogative to appoint the Speaker of Parliament, the election commissioners, the police, the Inspector General of Police, Attorney General. Everything is in the hand of the Prime Minister.
Mm.
So what we are saying is that that has to change. In a democracy, there has to be a check and balance. We do not want a Prime Minister that has no power, but neither do we want a dictator,
right,
in our democracy. So that has to change so that we have a more functioning democracy where there's proper check, institutional and legal check and balances in place.
All right. And on that note, thank you so much for joining me today, Thomas.
You're most welcome. It's a pleasure.
That was Thomas Phan, the chairperson of Bursa 2.0. And we were chatting about the unprecedented year of Malaysian politics that was 2020, some of the flaws in our democratic system, and what changes we need to see moving forward. So if you missed any part of this conversation or any previous Live and Learn episodes, you can check out the podcast on the BFM app, bfm.my, or you can even subscribe to us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or pretty much wherever you get your podcasts from. Once again, I'm Dashran Johan, and this has been Live and Learn on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.